You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on July 22nd, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, co-hosts Greg and Nate join me for a discussion of a big idea. Is healthcare a human right? Why or why not? Then, Nate and I discuss Central American children entering the U.S. without papers or adult guardians. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Nate, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
And also rejoining us on the line from Maryland is Greg. He's going to be joining us for one segment. Greg, welcome back.
Thank you.
This week, we're going to be talking about another kind of big conceptual idea. This one isn't necessarily specific to the United States, but it obviously has the most implications for the United States within the context of the industrialized economies of the world. And last week, we talked a little bit about this idea that I was pitching of having some sort of regional solutions for things, interstate compacts, and the example that we were working with was a single payer system. And part of the discussion that we had there, or the rationale for doing that, was that some areas of the country are vehemently opposed to a single payer system and some areas want it. And as Nate said, I believe last week, it almost just doesn't seem nationally feasible, not just politically, but just sort of from an implementation standpoint, to actually get a system in place nationally for something like that. But that's a policy issue. And then that gets into kind of a wider issue or a foundational issue there, which is, what is the goal of a system like that? Is that the best system to achieve a goal like that? And obviously, with all these health reform things, the goal seems to be about getting as many people as possible into a system where they can access healthcare. And obviously, the real core question at the root of all of that is healthcare a fundamental human right? And Greg wants to talk a little bit about that today and the pros and cons of looking at it that way and what the implications of that are and some various related implications. And I think this is going to get into not just issues of healthcare policy, but much wider issues of how the United States conceives of itself and various other rights for its citizens. So, Greg, where do we want to start on a big topic like this?
I think it's important that we sort of discuss where our heads are in terms of what we think of when we think of a fundamental right. Because I think that at least when the founding fathers were talking about it, they were talking about it perhaps from a religious standpoint, where human beings are born and because of the basis of their humanity, they are imbued with these certain rights that are enumerated in whatever, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and that sort of thing. But I don't know, maybe as like a contemporary, you know, 20 something in the United States of America that's sort of secular, I don't know if I totally subscribe to that sort of notion that there are fundamental rights based on our humanity. I just sort of think that as a society, we have decided that we are going to treat people in a certain way because it's the right thing to do, and it's not necessarily based on their humanity or whatever. It's just based on the way that we would like to be treated. So sort of like a golden rule type thing versus an essence type thing. It's more of an existential type of view of fundamental rights. But I think that the interesting thing is that that sort of worldview, at least my worldview on what is a fundamental right, doesn't, I guess, put boundaries around fundamental rights based on a person's humanity. You know, fundamental rights can be ever expanding based on what we decide we as a society would like to go forward and provide people with next. So I think that this is definitely something that's come up over the past 20 or so years, and especially over the past five with the passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the ACA or Obamacare, I guess, sort of correct the imbalances in the healthcare system with the notion that should have access to healthcare, and especially as somebody that is pursuing my master's degree in public health, there's definitely this notion among public health professionals. Having health is one of the, if not the most important thing that a person can have, especially in terms of them being able to leverage their other rights. So their other political rights, their other economic rights, their other social rights, because ultimately, if someone, citizen of the United States or a citizen of anywhere, doesn't have health, then they're not able to work. So they're not able to exercise their economic freedom. They're not able to maybe vote because they're sick, and so they're not able to exercise their political freedom. They're not able to express themselves in a social realm. So from a public health standpoint, among public health professionals, I think a lot of us, or I'm aspiring, but a lot of us believe that health is something from which all of these other rights spring. And before we started recording, Bill asked if I was going to talk about it in the sense of, do people have a fundamental right to health, or do people have a fundamental right to healthcare? And I think that it's an important semantic distinction, because I do think that they mean two different things. I don't think that anybody in the public health field is under any delusion that every single person in the world can have perfect health. I don't think that we think that. I don't think that that's even something that's ever going to really be attainable. But I do think that people within the public health field feel it is a fundamental right that there is an environment in which people can get the healthcare that they need. And not only the healthcare that they need, but there is an environment in which there's not pollution, there isn't things at their job that are potentially dangerous for them to be around, things in their homes, consumer products, all of these different things that should provide an environment for someone to achieve their own optimal health. We talk about that a lot. We talk about people's and public health, the public health, though. We talk about people achieving their optimal health. So not necessarily that they're perfectly healthy, but that given their makeup, that they are achieving their optimal health. And I think that that's clearly not happening right now in the United States of America and in a lot of other places, because we talk about these health disparities that we see poor people, people of color, that don't have necessarily anything different from maybe me or Bill or Nate, besides the fact that they're different socioeconomic status than us and maybe a different race or ethnicity than us, but that they don't necessarily have any different genetic makeup than us, and yet their health outcomes are so much worse. That's problematic. We want those types of people, including ourselves, but especially those types of people that have been sort of most burdened by the health disparities, to be able to achieve their optimal health. And that's what I sort of wanted to talk about in terms of fundamental right to healthcare, where people are provided with, you know, the instruments and the environment in which they can achieve their maximum health. And from that, they can go out and achieve economically, politically, socially, and the like.
So, Greg, starting to make the case here that the public health professional community is focused on finding a way to get the best possible health outcomes for every individual, given their circumstances, and also, I guess, the capacity of society to deliver that. Nate, what was your take on some of the points that Greg has raised so far, or this issue in general?
Yeah, I was interested in Greg's, how he talked about the concept of optimal health. And I think this goes back maybe a little bit to discussions we've had previously, and also more broadly on this entire topic. It seems like, at least with the passage of Obamacare, there seems to be a growing, not consensus because it's still a very divisive issue, but a growing understanding among some that there is a fundamental right to both health and healthcare in the United States, at least under some people's interpretations. The distinction I was going to make is, I think you should have a fundamental right to healthcare, but at the same point, you also kind of have a fundamental right to pay for that care. And, you know, that this is something that in many ways is the most pressing problem with the U.S. healthcare system, even perhaps more so than lack of access or lack of certain types of treatments. You know, you have thousands of people every year going bankrupt because of healthcare costs. You have a tremendous amount of specialists making money hand over fist for recommending, you know, perhaps unnecessary treatments, or just there are certain treatments now that that are so specialized and so expensive that, you know, you've got various doctors making a large amount of money on it, and perhaps the healthcare needs of the people are not being best served. So, I mean, I think this is just something we have to think about. How are we going to balance the desire to make sure everyone has both access to healthcare, gets quality, affordable healthcare, with, you know, the demands of the market and this basically this complex, the pharmaceutical industry, the various medical technology industries, of course, doctors, the AMA. How are we going to balance this to find a way where people are getting the treatment they need and deserve, but are also getting it at a way they can afford, and they're not being bankrupted by high healthcare costs, and they're not having to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars just for small procedures, things like that. So we can say that we all have a fundamental right to healthcare, but eventually we're also going to figure out how we can efficiently distribute that healthcare, how we can make sure it's affordable for everyone. So, I mean, it would be great just to say, okay, everyone has a right to healthcare, everyone's going to get access to healthcare. But unfortunately, if it's not affordable for those people, you know, that leads to more problems in the future.
Greg, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that issue of affordability of access to healthcare and the notion that people shouldn't be going bankrupt in accessing it, that the financial barrier should not be the difference between being able to get it and not.
A couple of issues that I think Nate touched on that I wanted to continue to discuss. I think one of the things that, you know, you both have pointed out is that people are going bankrupt from dealing with medical bills. And it's over 50% of bankruptcies in the United States of America. I think it's upwards of 60, 70, perhaps even 80%. I don't remember the exact statistic, but it's certainly over majority of bankruptcies in the United States of America are due at least in some part to outstanding medical bills. And it's very difficult in the moment when you're very sick and in danger of dying to say, I don't have the money for this. I can't do this. You not provide me with this because I'm not going to pay it back later. And yet when these people do get this service and then months, maybe years down the road, they're, you know, saddled with this incredible amount of debt, it's very problematic. And it causes a lot of people to have to, you know, go into either dire financial straits or declare bankruptcy and ruin their credit. And so that's definitely a problem. I think that one of the things that has sort of made this a reality is that our healthcare system in large part is a fee for service. So what that means when we talk about it, at least in the public health professional field, is that a doctor does something that's on the ICD-9 or ICD-10, whatever, and that's basically the coding system. So I give you a Botox injection for migraines in your forehead, and there's a code for that that says, I did this, so this is what I'm going to bill for it for insurance. And so from ICD-9 to ICD-10, there has been an enormous expansion of the things that have codes in the system, but there still is not necessarily things that have codes in the system like I sat down with the patient and I talked about some of the things that they can do while they're at home in order to make sure that they can maintain their health, things that they should be eating, types of exercises that should be doing. There's not a code for that. So doctors don't get paid for that. So doctors don't really have time to do that. The problem is that, you know, there's, I guess, an incentive to just provide as many services in a fee-for-service system as possible because you only get paid for the services that you provide. So the alternative to that is basically you just get paid in order to provide people with healthcare. It's not necessarily because you gave them a CT scan and then you gave them an EKG and then you prescribed them a medication. Those things wouldn't necessarily, each individual thing would get you some sort of fee for doing that, but it would be a more holistic approach where you provide a service that is broadly healthcare and you get paid for that, and it's not necessarily giving people tests and whatnot. So that's definitely a way in which people think that healthcare costs could be sort of reined in. But obviously that's very difficult because that's not how we do it right now. And, you know, healthcare costs are increasing. And I think that Congress has tried to rein in those costs and said, we're only going to let Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement go up X percent. It's usually like a single digit percentage per year. They'll say, we're going to let Medicare and Medicaid go up maybe, I don't know, 4% per year. And that's what they call a sustainable growth rate. They say, like, if it goes up at this rate, then we can sustain it and we'll be okay. And the reason that that's important more broadly is because insurance companies do look to Medicare and Medicaid in order to figure out what they should be charging for things, because it's usually 20 to 30% higher than Medicare or Medicaid reimburses. So if they're seeing a 4% increase in Medicare and Medicaid, then they'll basically keep their reimbursement rate at about the same level. Again, it is, you know, at a higher rate, but still it'll grow at the same rate. But the problem is that even though we've had Congress pass these sort of bills that say we're going to have this sustainable growth in our medical spending, they haven't followed it. So we're increasing by 8%, 10% a year, especially as they pass other bills that say we're not going to go and do follow the sustainable growth rate this year. We'll do it next year. And so every year that we're putting it off, every year that we're saying we can grow Medicare or Medicaid beyond, say, a 4% sustainable growth rate, we get farther and farther away from sort of the slope of the line that we were aiming for in order to have, you know, a sustainable growth. We're growing these two lines, the actual growth, which is maybe advancing at 8 to 10%, and the sustainable growth that's advancing at 4%, these two slopes are getting more and more and more divergent. And so it's becoming more and more difficult down the road in order to get people to say, no, we need to get back to this 4% growth rate, because people can't do it. So that's another one of the issues, certainly.
Yeah, I just wanted to add in that the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Atlas has done a great job at tracking some of these cost disparities on different parts of the country. They have been collecting a lot of data over the past couple of years over just basically tracking on, you know, what different types of treatments are used in what different parts of the country and the various different costs associated with them. And that's, some of that data has led a lot of people in the public health sphere and also just in popular media. I remember Atul Gawande wrote an article for The New Yorker drawing on some of this data. And, you know, just it's beginning to lead to a discussion on how we change this sort of fee system to lead to better health outcomes, better primary care practices, just a better, more personal time spent with patients instead of just shuffling them from one test to another. That often at times is necessary, obviously, but at the same time, maybe you are sacrificing a rapport with the patient, and, you know, that doesn't necessarily lead to the best health outcomes if you're not very connected with your doctor and you're constantly having to, you know, pay thousands of dollars for tests that you may or may not need.
Right, right. I mean, you can actually take a look at that if you wanted to. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a couple of months ago, they had this huge data dump. They released this data set of every single doctor that accepted Medicare payments in 2012. And they showed, okay, this is the Medicare reimbursement money that we gave to this particular doctor. And then you could actually break it down. These are the individual things that they did. So it's really interesting to sort of see these doctors that are getting reimbursed at extremely high rates from Medicare. Oftentimes they'll own maybe an x-ray facility, or they'll be co-owners of an x-ray facility. And so they may or may not be more likely to recommend a CT scan for somebody and then send them over there, because then they're getting paid for the consultation and they're also getting paid when the patient has the CT scan at a place that they own.
So I was wondering if we could get kind of back onto that fundamental healthcare issue and what are fundamental rights and things like that. I mean, there's a number of different directions to go in that. At the beginning of the segment, Greg, you were talking about this idea that there's been a sort of expansion since those early fundamental rights, you know, the Declaration of Independence type rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which in turn was a modification of John Locke's life, liberty, and property. So obviously there's always been some amount of flexibility in what we consider to be fundamental human rights. And you made the point that some of that is less about, oh, did this come from an innate source because we are all humans or because of God or something like that? And maybe it's more about kind of the capacity and ability to execute these sort of rights, right? Like, you can't have a right to life and liberty if you cannot prevent you from being randomly murdered at the drop of a hat.
Sure.
Obviously, can't always prevent that. But if you're going by, you know, the state of nature arguments in philosophy, where, you know, the Hobbesian style ones where everything was chaos and everyone's life was short and terrible, that was his argument for why you need a government. And of course, he was writing that during the English Civil War when everything was falling apart around him. But some of this has to do with you need to have the ability to do something in place. I think of particular note, I think you had alluded to the idea that sometimes these sort of 18th century philosophical concepts seem really out of date at this point. And I mean, that's a good point because, you know, we talked a lot last week about why is it that the Constitution of 1787 should be considered so sacrosanct today. I mean, there's so many things that they couldn't possibly have anticipated and envisioned at the time when they were writing it. We should be able to make some appropriate modifications. To that point, and specifically with regard to healthcare essentially didn't exist in the 18th century, you know, when a lot of these philosophers, or the 17th certainly, when Hobbes was writing. Obviously, there's always been periods in history and in different parts of the world where levels of kind of medical treatment were more advanced or less advanced than peer states and peer civilizations. The Muslim world for a long time had some pretty awesome medical procedures going on. And then, you know, they also had a period where things sort of stagnated, just like Western Europe had. And you get similar phases of advancement and then kind of sliding backward in China and India and all sorts of places all over the world. But, you know, from the perspective of, again, the United States, which is our primary focus, late 18th century United States basically didn't have healthcare. There were so many things that they didn't even know the causes of.
They were super concerned about the humors and the different types, you know, got to get rid of the bile.
The entire concept was if your four humors were in balance, so that's black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm. If those were in balance, then phlegm. You needed to get them back in balance. So people were just getting, you know, they were going to barber shops and getting bled to death.
Get the leeches.
Right. And obviously, you know, late 18th century, they're doing better than, you know, late 17th century, and they're doing better in the late 17th century than in the late 15th. But, you know, that kind of thing, it was a work in progress. They still had a long, long way to go before they even got close. I mean, a lot of the stuff is really 20th century at this point in the United States, where we started getting back on track. And even today, there are some things that we're still arguably doing kind of wrong, maybe not intentionally or because of some weird mythological belief. But for example, with pain control, we just don't really understand how to do it better and more effectively. So it's always kind of a work in progress. But, you know, if you're looking at it now compared to, you know, late 1700s, when Thomas Jefferson is writing out the inalienable rights, there's not a concept of healthcare because it's simply impossible to deliver. We don't have the means to deliver it, both financially and technologically. We don't have the knowledge to do it because we don't understand, like, bacteria and sterilization and things like that. Just really basic concepts. And so in some ways, you have to think about expanding the parameters of what is a universal fundamental human right, or just what's a fundamental human right in general, because obviously there are some things where it's like, well, it would be nice if we could keep everyone from getting sick in, you know, 1787 or 1776, but we simply do not understand how to do that. But today we have that knowledge. So that's probably the single biggest, most compelling argument to me as to why we should consider including that in an expanded definition.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't think that it's appropriate to fault, you know, the founding fathers necessarily for not including healthcare, because they didn't know any better. But now that we do know better, isn't it incumbent upon us to say, this is a good thing, we know what we're doing, so let's provide people with it? I mean, obviously it's not that easy. If it was that easy, then I don't know, I would be trying to get a different master's degree. But now that we know, like you were saying, about how to provide people with healthcare, at least in some part, then we should be doing more in order to provide everybody with that, so that everybody can, like I was saying before, achieve their optimal health. That's what we're always talking about. We always in public health want everybody to achieve their optimal health.
Right. The greatest number of people being healthy within the society as is economically and technologically possible, I guess, is another way of framing that. And another thing that you had mentioned very early in the segment was this notion, which comes up in campaign trail stuff a lot when they're campaigning on health reform, this idea that the ability to have access to healthcare, reasonably good quality healthcare, and not go bankrupt from it is a precondition to a lot of other things. I think we might deem this to be sort of a preconditional human human right or fundamental right, which is to say that, as you said, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or even indeed maintaining your property, those four other things are conditional upon your health care and your resulting finances from your health care. And obviously, again, it's like with talking about income inequality or something, nobody's really making the argument that everyone needs to be equal or whatever, because that would be the right to health as opposed to the right to health care, which is saying everyone in the country has to have the equivalent level of health. Everyone needs to be exactly as healthy as everyone else. That's obviously never going to happen, and no one's suggesting that it is, but it's the idea that everyone should be able to get at least some minimum basic quality of care and not go bankrupt from it. I mean, we've talked a lot in this past half hour about this concept of kind of people having financial difficulties because of the costs, and maybe some of the costs being artificially exploded by various misaligned incentives. But it seems like this is another reason for arguing that this should be considered a fundamental right, is that it's a precondition to the ability to meet these other rights. And I think that it also speaks to the point that if it's the government's job to provide for the maintenance and protection of those other three fundamental rights or so, or some of the other ones that have been identified in the Constitution and by the Supreme Court subsequent to the Declaration of Independence, if it's the government's job to do that, then it's the government's job also to figure out a system that will allow everyone an appropriate level of minimum care. And that starts to get into the arguments of, well, how do you do that? And should it be done through an employer-based system with the government filling the gaps, or making sure that people who are covered by these government mandates, that they're getting a certain level of care from their employer-based insurance systems? And I mean, that gets into the issues that Sasha brought up several weeks ago when we were talking about the Hobby Lobby case, which is this idea that if you have the employer-based healthcare system, then the government's got to have some role in dictating what is included in that, or else the government needs to be doing it entirely on its own. Again, maybe some people still don't accept the premise that it's a fundamental right, but to me, it's getting harder and harder to make the case that it's not.
So what we do have in terms of a government-guaranteed fundamental right to healthcare, we do have it in a very, very, very limited sense in the statute, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, EMTALA, which basically states that if you show up at an emergency room and you're having some really serious issue where you could die, they need to stabilize you. They don't need to treat you, but they basically need to prevent you from dying in the next hour, regardless of your ability to pay. So you show up at the ER, you're having a heart attack. They do need to stabilize you. But after that, their obligation, at least under statutory restrictions, is completely done. This is literally the only statute on the books that says you have limited right to health care. Now, obviously, a lot of emergency rooms go above and beyond what is required by law in EMTALA, and they'll provide people with treatment sometimes regardless of their ability to pay, but the government does not guarantee that you would receive that treatment. So it basically, like I said, only guarantees that if you show up at a place and you're, on the brink of death, that they stabilize you and make sure that you don't die within the next, couple of hours, and that's it. That's our only guarantee for healthcare in the United States of America.
Right, and sometimes you hear the conservatives, the Republicans saying, oh, well, we don't need anything more. That's good enough. That's already on the books. And I mean, aside from all the problems that causes in emergency rooms, it's, themselves, and kind of just backlogging everything and then ultimately costing far more than, preventive care and things like that, there's the simple reality that the hospitals and the insurance and everyone else then has to pick up the tab on the people who are having to rely on this because they can't afford any other treatment. And the consequence demonstrated time and again of this is that lower volume rural hospitals in rural conservative areas go bankrupt and close because the percentage of people that are too wealthy to qualify for Medicaid, or don't have a job or whatever, but too poor to be able to pay for it on their own, those people are going to the emergency room, and then the hospitals are going bankrupt, and then the hospitals are closing, which then puts even more pressure on other hospitals and makes the care even farther away. I mean, Nate and I, and I think this is true for you as well, Greg, we're all in areas that have hospitals like literally right down the street. The hospitals, you know, within the radius of Boston and in your case, Greg, you know, in the whole DC area. I mean, there you got world-class hospitals, they're easy to get to, etc. But if you go into some of these other areas, it can be 20, 40, 50 miles before you get to a hospital. And that right there is degrading the care, you know, and then that gets into issues of maybe we need to be investing in more, you know, government subsidized health clinics and things like that. But that's a whole separate issue. But the areas that need this sort of government provision of healthcare or some sort of fundamental right beyond emergency room treatment, the areas that need that the most are the most conservative Republican areas in the country.
But that's certainly not the only issue that we're having with people that are unable to pay for healthcare showing up at hospitals. So the other situation that we're having, that we're seeing, is that there are people that are in, you know, well-to-do areas. So say, like, you know, people in Baltimore are not necessarily well-to-do areas, but there are very good hospitals in the area. So say people in Baltimore are showing up to Johns Hopkins, which is honestly one of the best hospitals, especially in terms of cancer care in the world. They're showing up there. They're not able to pay. There are people in Baltimore that are able to pay for their health care. So what happens is that the people that show up to the emergency room and can't pay, there needs to be some sort of cost compensation for the hospital, or they're not going to be able to continue to keep operating. And so what the hospitals do out of necessity is they charge the people that can pay more for their health care. So that makes health care prices increase across the board, because again, you know, hospitals aren't getting payment for services that they're providing to lower socioeconomic people. So they're charging the higher socioeconomic people more to compensate for it, and everyone's healthcare goes up.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like over the past couple of years, we're moving towards a better understanding of what healthcare means for everyone and what sort of responsibilities we have to everyone else in terms of ensuring an optimally healthy society. But we're still a long way to go. There have been so many problems with the rollout of Obamacare, both just political and logistical. So, I mean, we're going to have to update and upgrade that over the next couple decades. And there's still a lot of work to be done, clearly. But it seems like we're at least moving in the right direction.
All right. Well, Greg, you know, I know you wanted to talk more about some other angles of this and potentially what needs to be covered in that sort of minimum basic care definition that we've been talking about periodically throughout this segment. But we are out of time on this segment, so I'm sure we'll have you back on another show to kind of talk about some of those more intangibles like the home care and the mental health and things like that that aren't as quite as obvious as, you know, keeping someone from bleeding out on the table in front of you type of care. Greg, thank you for joining us to talk about this issue this week.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment.